I did think it was somewhat unusual, and now I realize it was only me who was unusual, to start off with a discussion of such a rather difficult subject. Difficult only in the sense, not that it's not vitally important, because I believe that it is, but difficult in the sense that sadly for many in evangelicalism today, the idea that God's nature and God's being could be central not only to the apologetic task, but also to, I would say, to every task, especially every pastoral task. When I speak of open theism, I do so as one who, in God's providence, had to work as a chaplain in a hospital for a number of years. And I had to run loss support groups. It was not a Christian hospital, and so I was dealing with individuals who were not believers most of the time. And so I come to this with an element in my own background that makes me even more concerned about the subject of open theism, because I see it as striking at the very ground of of our ability to give not only counsel, but comfort in the face of tragedy. There are tremendously practical implications on a pastoral level to what you believe about God. And in fact, I would like to suggest that if what we believe about God does not impact our pastoral counseling, we've got things absolutely backwards. Unfortunately, that's how it happens in many situations. We grab onto an ism, we grab onto a program, something that's supposed to quote-unquote work, and then that ends up determining our theology rather than our theology determining what it is we're going to say and how it is we're going to deal with people. In the doctrine of God, when I teach systematic theology for Golden Gate Seminary, I try, vainly at times, to convince my students that the old model is really not that far off. And what I mean by that is that in the olden days, systematic theology was the core, it was the hub, and from it went all the other elements of a theological education. Hence, if you had a class on the doctrine of the church, it was related to what you believed systematically, what you believed about the church, what you believed about the Word of God, what you believed about the ministry. You brought all these things together, and there was this quaint idea that what you believed about this over here should be consistent with what you believed about this doctrine over here. I say quaint because I hate to report to you that in the large portion of theological education today, that's no longer the case. In fact, in many seminaries, systematic theology has pretty much moved from the central position to the church history section. The idea being there were people who used to actually once believe that you could form a systematic theology. There used to be people who thought that the Bible was so clear, that revelation was so perspicuous, that you could create a systematic theology. How odd. We've moved beyond that now. And now we know that, well, you can't even really develop a Pauline theology, can you? In many seminaries today, you can't say the Apostle Paul said X, Y, or Z, because you look at his epistles, and well, he didn't actually write this whole section here. And of these ones here, we find, and I love this word, tension. Isn't that a wonderful theological term? Don't you hear it all the time? There's tension in Paul. That's the nice way of saying that Paul contradicted Paul. We don't want to use the term contradiction because that's too black and white. And so in a nice postmodern way, we talk about tension. And of course, that's assuming that Paul and Peter are at loggerheads and they're constantly arguing with one another. And James, oh good grief, he was, you know, way out on the other end over there. So the result of all this is what? Well, sadly, many people come out of our seminaries today and we wonder where the bold proclamation went. And I'm not talking about a narrow proclamation. There's a difference between a narrow proclamation and a bold proclamation. I'm not talking about a narrowness of mind where we don't know what anyone else believes. I'm not talking about a narrowness of mind that says, don't confuse me with facts. I don't want to know about facts. I don't want to know about other viewpoints. but a boldness of proclamation that grows out of a confidence that God indeed has given us His Word. He's preserved His Word for us, and He has promised that His truth would always be with His people. We wonder where that went. We pray for it, and then what do? Well, we basically don't take the time to consider what's being taught and what's being promulgated. And hence, we have a movement today, and I guess I'll go ahead and move over to, if I can here. I was just trying to get things set up, and it's... Now, try doing this upside down and backwards, folks. Let's see if you can figure this one out. That's not easily done, especially with these wonderful touchpads. Aren't they great? Who invented the touchpad? I'd like to find out and do something really bad to them. Let's do it this way. It's a little bit easier to see, isn't it? There are those teaching within evangelical churches today that today, which is the 20th of August, 2004, God may be quite nervous. He may be very nervous. Why would God be nervous on August 20th of 2004? Well, it's possible that something really bad could happen tomorrow. Maybe there are people plotting something horrible today, just like they were on September 10th, 2001. And I imagine God was fairly nervous on September 10th, 2001, too. Because from their perspective, God has all possible knowledge. Possible knowledge. What does that mean? Well, God has exhaustive knowledge of the present reality in this creation. And God can see the possibilities. But you see, the future does not exist. And so since the future does not exist, God does not have exhaustive knowledge of it. And hence, in part, it is open. It is open because that portion of the future that God does not know, because it does not yet exist, is that portion of the future that is going to come about through the actions of free creatures. And God does not know what free creatures will do. Now, someone may immediately say, well, wait a minute. If you say He has perfect knowledge of the present, and He has had perfect knowledge of the present all along, then that means He has had perfect knowledge of everything I have ever done, every thought I have ever had, and how I've acted on every impulse I've ever had. So don't you think that if you had perfect knowledge of an individual from the time they were conceived until they are 25 years of age, whatever, that you might have a pretty decent idea what they're going to do? Yeah, but people are people. And don't people do odd things? Haven't you ever surprised yourself? Haven't you ever been going through the cafeteria line let's put it this way. My wife would probably faint if going through a cafeteria line, I reached out and got almost any vegetable that God has ever created. I am a dietitian's nightmare in many ways. There are a few vegetables. There's corn on the cob and peas and corn and peas. That's about it. So almost anything else in that particular, if I reached out there and grabbed hold of some broccoli, my wife would faint. So would my kids. They'd have a celebration. They'd just think it was great. So sometimes we do surprise even those who know us best. I may do that someday. I'm probably not going to eat it, but I may grab it anyways, just simply to see what they would do. So sometimes we surprise ourselves, and evidently, sometimes we surprise God too. And so on September 10th, God knew the intentions of all those men. He knew what they intended to do. He had been watching this whole thing. But you see, God couldn't know because, you see, how many actions that take place in our world are not just the result of one person's free choices, but of many people's free choices. I mean, just look at what happened on that day. On one aircraft, they decided to fight back. That aircraft didn't hit a building, did it? But they didn't really have that opportunity on the other ones. They didn't know what was going on. And so what if they had fought back? What if there had been a particularly sharp security guy that day? What if? The point is, God could not know. God could not know what was going to happen on September 11th. And even then, he could not know that the buildings would collapse when they were hit. He couldn't know that. Why? Because he couldn't know where the planes were going to hit. That was the result of free will choices as well. So God didn't know that 3,000 people or more were going to die that day. He does not know the date of the death of any individual. In fact, from this perspective, when God created, he did not know any single one of us would ever exist. Think of how many free will choices have gone into your existence over time. All the choices of who to marry and who not to marry. To have kids, not to have kids. I mean, obviously, from this perspective, when God created, he chose to make the human race, but he had no concept of who was going to be born, who is going to live. Now, if you're thinking with me this early in the morning, you're going, wow, boy, about everything we've ever believed about God having a purpose and a plan in this world has to become exceptionally vague. It has to become, there can be no specificity in it outside of God intends to win in the end. But who and how could God know any of that? And indeed, some of the leading proponents of this perspective will tell us, for example, some of you have heard a debate I did at Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando, also in 2001. Against Dr. John Sanders. Dr. Sanders is one of, I would say, the three most popular, maybe not, well, prolific as far as books goes, too, would be a fair statement as well. John Sanders, Clark Pinnock, and Gregory Boyd would be the three most prolific. Certainly they were the ones chosen by the Evangelical Theological Society to write, and if any of you are really looking for information on this subject, what you might want to do is get hold of the June 2001 or 2002. I'd have to look at the specifics again. It was the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society where, in essence, it was a three-on-one debate. Gregory Boyd, Clark Pinnock, and John Sanders versus Bruce Ware. I think Michael Horton may have thrown something in there, too, as I'm thinking about it now. But anyway, excellent journal to get hold of if you want to have information on the subject of open theism. Anyways, Dr. Sanders, in his book on this subject, said that in God's plan, while the incarnation had been a part of God's eternal plan, the cross was not. Now, I've always wondered about that. What that would have to result in a non-salvific purpose of the incarnation. What was God just going to visit for a while, or exactly what was the purpose here? You know, I've never found anything in Scripture about the incarnation separate from the purpose of the cross. You know, they seem to be inextricably linked in everything I've ever seen. But the point being that for Sanders, the dialogue of the prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane, for it to have any meaning, had to mean that even at that point, the cross was not a certainty. The cross was not something that was necessarily a part of God's purpose. And so Sanders will go so far as to say that God was surprised when Adam fell. He knew it was a possibility. You see, God knows the possibilities. God knew the possibility when he created that Adam might fall, but he considered it to be a tremendously unlikely event. And ever since then, he's been dealing with the rather tragic results of that unintended event. Now you might say, well, this open theism, it sounds a little bit like ancient Socinianism. Going back quite some time, they likewise denied to God exhaustive foreknowledge of future events, but they also had all sorts of other wild stuff where they denied the deity of Christ and things like that. So there are differences, obviously. That's true, but this movement has found a home in conservative evangelical churches. And the reason isn't all that difficult to discern. You see, you can present this perspective in a very attractive way. You can present this perspective in a very attractive way that tugs at the emotion. And sadly, in many places in our land today, emotion is the primary developing force of theology, not scriptural exegesis. We live in a postmodern society. And hence, it is so easy to see in our society how people are swayed by horrifically bad arguments that have no logical consistency to them whatsoever, but it's all a matter of my truth, my preferences, your preferences. We see that. This is a political season. And if you want to see the low value placed upon truth in our society, just watch a little television, listen to a little radio. It's a sad thing, and face it, the church is deeply influenced by the culture in which we live. And even though the scriptures do not even begin to give us this kind of a very wishy-washy style of belief and theology, yet we bring that in from outside and then apply it to the scriptures and apply it to our theology. And so there are those who are presenting the idea that, look, the old doctrinal way of looking at things turns God into a cold, remote tyrant. Certainly God must relate with you as we relate to one another, or everything we see in Scripture becomes nothing but a charade, a fake. And then there's always lots of stories to tell. One of the most famous stories, I don't know that he ever intended it this way, but Pastor Gregory Boyd from up at Bethel Seminary tells the story of a parishioner who did everything right. She sought pastoral counsel before her. She did not rush into anything. She fasted and prayed. They went through premarital counseling. Everybody in the church said this is a perfect match. I mean, they did everything by the book. And she comes to Pastor Boyd. She's been abandoned. She's been cheated upon. Her heart's been trampled upon. And she says to him, if I didn't hear from God before this marriage, then you can't hear from God. You can't tell me a thing I didn't do. I did everything by the book. And if I didn't hear from God, then that means you can't hear from God. And it's all a joke. Those are compelling stories, because Dr. Boyd goes on to say, how do you respond to that? And all of us feel the weight of having to deal with practical applications of theology. And there's nothing wrong with the practical applications of theology. In fact, the greatest heresies have actually developed when theology was allowed to exist by itself off in some ivory tower and didn't have to interact with the people in the church, the people in the pews. So we understand the importance of looking at practical examples, and we would have to give an answer, given our doctrine of God, to that lady. Because it's one thing to sit in the systematic theology class, and it's one thing for the professor to go, very good, young man. You read your lesson. You read your 14 systematic theologies last night. You've slept only, 30 minutes in the past three days, and that's what it's supposed to be a seminary student. Some of you are grinning. Some of you are grimacing. It's one thing to stand there and get the accolades, pat on the back from the professor. It's something completely different to sit in the office with that lady. And she's expecting an answer. You know what Boyd's answer was? Here's what Boyd's answer was. You did hear from God. You did hear from God. God instructed you to marry. And what your husband did, God never expected. God never expected he would do that. As far as God could see, at that point in time, you were the perfect match. And so all of us agreed that God gave us the go-ahead on that marriage. And God is grieved at what your husband has done. His heart's broken. But there's nothing you can do about it. Now he'll help you to put your life back together again. That was his answer. What's wrong with that answer? I mean, she seemed to accept it. There are many people seeming to accept that today. In fact, when I became a hospital chaplain, I remember I had no experience in it. I had graduated from seminary, but I had focused upon theological classes primarily in seminary because that's what my ministry was about. And there hadn't really been any classes offered that I could recall that would have been exceptionally relevant anyways. And I remember before I first began that work, I went down to the Christian bookstore and looked through the Christian counseling section. Boy, was that a shock. And I'm looking through all these books, and I buy five or six of them, and I take them home. And I'm sitting there reading them. And every one of them basically says the same thing. And they pretty much all were coming from what I would identify now as an open theistic perspective. Don't blame God for any of this. God was otherwise indisposed, I guess. I'm really not sure exactly what their position was. They weren't overly consistent in their theology. But the idea was separate God from the tragedy. And I remember spending a completely sleepless night. Because I knew, and it ended up working out this way, when you work as a hospital chaplain, anyone ever done any hospital chaplaincy here? And let me tell you something. That is one of the hardest jobs you could ever do. I don't know how anybody does it on a long-term basis. I really don't. In a large hospital, and I live in Phoenix, and I know if you've never been out that direction, some people figure all of us who live in Phoenix wear 10-gallon hats and eat rattlesnake and things like that, and ride horses and stuff like that. How many of you know where Phoenix ranks as far as size and population in the United States? Anybody have any idea? Number 5. We just passed Philly, just passed Philadelphia. There are only 4 cities in Chicago, New York, L.A., and somebody else. Huh? Houston, y'all. It's a big city. It's a hot city, but it's a dry city in comparison to this. Let me tell you something. we don't have any major sports teams at the moment, but some of you are going, yes, you do. No, we really don't. In fact, if any of you back here, how about the Middletown Cardinals? Would you like to have an NFL team? We'd like to send you one. We really would. it's pretty sad. it's a large hospital there in the Phoenix area, and I knew already from having been there a few times that there was this sound, there was this bell that would go off when they had a code, cardiac arrest, anywhere in the hospital. And my job was to drop whatever I was doing and to get there ASAP. Now, I'll be honest with you, it's been a number of years since I worked there, and still when I hear any sound even semi like that, I break out in a cold sweat. I truly do. And I knew that very first night that I might be facing that situation. And I did. The very first night I was there alone without anybody else, had a code, and it resulted in death. very first night. And so I'm reading these books very seriously. I had a sleepless night. Because the problem was, everything I was reading in these books was telling me to deny what I believed about God. I read in the Bible that not only is God sovereign over all things, but He's sovereign over life and death. There's something in the Psalms about the length of my life being known to God. My birth, my death. And I had this theology that told me that God has a purpose in all things. And when you face tragedy, the comfort is to be found not in a God who was just as shocked as you were, but in a God who had a purpose that transcended even my knowledge of what that tragedy might be. And so all these books are telling me to counsel the exact opposite way of what I believed. Well, I came to a conclusion. It wasn't very long, by the way, before I discovered that when you are in an emergency room, and my job, in essence, at that time was when they were bringing somebody in by ambulance, for example, to the emergency room, my job was to get there when the firemen are coming toward the door. It's one of those motion sensor things. I'd sort of stick my notepad that I always had with me out to get the door open so they could get through without having to pause. And then I'm supposed to watch. Where's the family? Where's the family? I grabbed the family, and we had this room that might have been about the size of these two pews right here. This little section is tiny. That might be even larger now that I think about it. And I had to shuttle them in there, and my job was to be the go-between between the emergency room doctors, staff, and the family. And I learned pretty quickly that in the emergency room, that's not the place for a whole lot of extended discussions of theology. That's a place of raw emotion. I saw every kind of... Thankfully, we were in a trauma one level center, or I would have seen a whole lot more. That would have been really incredible. But I saw a lot of... I had never seen anyone die before. That sobers you. That changes you. Especially up in CCU. In fact, one of the things I learned in CCU is I walk in there and see somebody with all those tubes and wires and stuff like that. They could have pulled up to that hospital in a Lexus or a 74 Volkswagen, and you all look the same in one of those beds. Doesn't matter what you got. Doesn't matter. You all look the same. And I saw good deaths and I saw bad deaths. I saw a lot of despair. I saw a lot of people just had no hope. And I remember the 95-year-old Christian man. Every time the CCU, the nurses would come to take blood, he'd say, "Thank you, honey." I mean, they just poked him. And he'd go, "Thank you, honey." And they just loved him. But they knew he was dying. And one of the nurses took me aside one day and said, "I've got to tell you what he said." He said, I started talking to him. I said, "You know you're dying, don't you?" And he says, "Yes." And she says, "Are you afraid?" And he said, "Honey..." Old men say honey to everybody, to ladies especially. "Honey," he said, "I've been talking with God for over 90 years. Why would I be afraid to go see Him?" And man, that's something you remember, you know. And it just so happens, ha 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 ha, that I was on duty, walked into CCU. He didn't have any of his close relatives living in this area. That was one of the difficult things being in Phoenix, is that we'd have numbers of people who would come in, older people who had retired out there, but their family wasn't anywhere near Phoenix. They all lived back here someplace. And the sad thing was, many of them came out there, and then they never got involved in the church. I can't tell you how many times I'd walk into somebody's room, and I'd look at the little thing here. It says Baptist or something. It says, "Where do you go to church?" "Well, we used to be a member of Brother So-and-so's church in Illinois. And then we moved out here, and We've been looking. We just haven't found any place. How long have you been here? 26 years. Pretty arid place out there in Arizona as far as churches go, I guess. But anyway, I came in and there was a sort of extended relative, one of the only relatives I had seen with this elderly man. And so I visited with her because he had slipped away. He had slipped into a coma. I visited with her, and while I was standing there, after a while, especially since I was a biology major in college, I started learning to recognize things. And I could tell as I was standing there, he was slipping away. The nurse came in. Nurse stood on one side. Relative stood on this side, held his hand. And he slipped into eternity while we stood there. That was so different than so many of the others. So many of the others that we encountered. I came to the conclusion, sorry about the extended personal story there, but I came to the conclusion very early on in that work that I could not, to make my job easier, steal from someone the greatest hope I could offer them just simply to make it easier for me to give an answer. What do I mean by that? I couldn't look someone in the eye and say, God had no purpose in this tragedy, and then turn around and say, but God has a wonderful purpose for your life. People tend to recognize, wait a minute, those two don't fit. You mean he has a wonderful purpose for me, but didn't have one for my loved one? How does that work? I couldn't steal from them the greatest thing I could tell them just to try to make my job easier. But I discovered that that really wasn't something that happened much in the emergency room. It was something that happened in the lost support group, the people who were 6 months out. And that's why there's a book. We don't have it downstairs. Most of you have never heard of it. But I actually wrote a book on grieving. A couple years after I wasn't at the hospital anymore, a friend of mine's 29-day-old granddaughter died. His daughter had a epileptic seizure, rolled over on the baby, and the baby suffocated. And after the funeral, I went back to my office, and I just cleared everything off my desk, and I started writing. And 4 days later, this little book came into existence. And I only wrote it for him. I wasn't thinking book when I wrote it. But once I did, I sent it to my editor at Bethany House. And he read it, and he said, man, I want this, but, yeah, he said, before I bring it into the publishing house, I'm going to take your name off it. Okay, he said, because look at the books you've written, the Roman Catholic controversy, the King James only controversy. What's this going to be, the grieving controversy? I mean, that's just not going to work. So they took my name off it, and they brought it anonymously. And they had the inside readers, publishers, editors, read it without a name on it. And they loved it, and they wanted it. And only then did my editor say, okay, well, that's actually James White. And they're like, come on, no way. That's actually him. So it's actually done very, very well, amazingly enough. But it's an incredibly tough subject. And that's, I guess, one of the reasons why I don't fit into a lot of the categories that people would like me to fit into, because when I approach something like open theism, hopefully I approach it by accurately representing what they're saying. Hopefully that's the scholarly part, is to accurately represent what's being said. But I don't know how to approach theology without passion. I don't understand it. I think it's a sin to teach a theology class and bore people to death. I don't understand. Beyond me. Utterly and completely beyond me. I do not comprehend it. I mean, I know scholars who teach theology because they're scholars. And it's a scholarly subject, and therefore they're going to teach it. I don't understand that. When I teach theology, that's life. You know, I don't know how you separate the two of them. I really honestly do not follow any of that. So when I approach this subject, okay, I've got some biases. Then again, so do they. I mean, Dr. Sanders even mentions in his book that one of the major forces that moved him the direction he's moving was the death of his brother in a motorcycle accident. So none of us are immune to those external forces that are out there. We all get caught up in that type of thing. So just briefly this morning, I would like to address this issue of open theism. And if you're not familiar with it, hopefully you will be. If you've not encountered it, hopefully if you see it coming into your church, you'll be familiar with it. And if at the very least, even if it's not a possibility in your context, thinking about these things will again prompt us to consider the truths of God's great and glorious sovereignty. Most of you are familiar with these words. God from all eternity did by the most wise and holy counsel of his own will freely and unchangeably ordain whatsoever comes to pass, yet so as thereby neither is God the author of sin, nor is violence offered to the will of the creatures, nor is the liberty or contingency of second causes taken away, but rather established. That is the historic statement of the Westminster Confession, also found in the London Baptist Confession of 1689, in almost word for word, as far as that goes. And it is the assertion of God's absolute sovereignty and the grounding in that sovereignty of the will of man, and the fact that God uses secondary causes, secondary means for the accomplishment of his ends. Well, obviously, it is that very statement that open theism says no way. No way. Such a God cannot be personal. Such a God cannot be interactive. Such a God cannot be human. Now, they would not use that. Well, I'll take that back. Most would not use that term. I think there are some who would. And I think as open theism continues to develop, and it is developing, if any of you have heard the debate that Dr. Sanders and I did at RTS, in response to one of my questions, he did reply by saying, well, look, open theism is fairly new. We haven't figured out all the passages yet. You've had hundreds of years to get your story straight. So think about that one for a few seconds, and you'll see why I sort of chuckle a little bit at that particular point in time. The heart of open theism. You read Pinnock. And Pinnock is the bleeding edge, okay? Pinnock, did anyone ever know Clark Pinnock back when he was a conservative? I'm sorry, you're too young to know that. I was going to say, and you were three at that time? yes, he had like the ugly green book on inerrancy from the 1970s was not bad at all. There was a time when Clark Pinnock was a conservative. He ain't no more. Not only is he an open theist, but he believes in post-mortem evangelization. He's an inclusivist, denies the existence of conscious punishment in hell, and you name it, and that's where he's gone. And he's out here. And then you have Gregory Boyd. He's sort of over here. He's not fully really an inclusivist, but he's an open theist. And you got John Sanders. And John Sanders is John Sanders more than once sort of smiled a rather sly smile during the course of our debate whenever I'd quote Clark Pinnock. He didn't quite put it this way, but I saw in his face sort of the thought, oh, I wish Clark would be a little more careful with his words. And he didn't really want to be held accountable for everything that Pinnock said, which I understand. I mean, that's certainly a fair thing. There are a few folks on my side of the fence that I wouldn't necessarily want to be accountable for everything they said either. But you have this range of perspectives. And the one thing that holds them all together, the one thing that I really find to be absolutely central in their perspective is not free will. Because you know that Augustine used free will. You know that Calvin used free will. Everybody uses the term free will. It's what you mean by that that is important. What is at the central of the very heart of open theism is libertarian free will. A free will unfettered by a decree of God, unfettered by divine sovereignty, outside of, all of them would at least say this, God is sovereign to create droughts and earthquakes and natural disasters of Hurricane Charley, for example, drew a bead on Tom Askell's house in with 145 mile an hour winds whipping around outside, which causes you to contemplate the smallness of your life and its possible brevity as well. But God is free to basically mess with nature is sort of the viewpoint, and therefore our wills can sort of get messed up because if you're in the middle of a 145 mile an hour wind, you may decide, your free will may say, I'm going to go walk the dog right now. But the reality is not going to allow you to go walk the dog. You and the dog may fly, but you're not going to be walking. So they will at least say on that level that when God decides to whip a hurricane across Central Florida, which he does every decade or so, that our wills at that point don't really get to say much about it. But outside of that, outside of natural disasters, a libertarianly free will is a will that when faced with a choice cannot be determined. Hence, that free will can choose A or B, and God cannot in any way, shape, or form impact that without denying to the creature, in the words of Norman Geisler, his humanity. For a person committed to libertarian free will over against a compatibilist view, which is what I would hold, a person committed to that perspective really believes that the idea of the previous screen there in regards to God's sovereignty dehumanizes man, turns man into a mere puppet on the string, which you have heard probably many, many times. This becomes the central focus. Everything else in the system has to support this central platform, including the doctrine of God. Now, historically, Reformed folks have made the doctrine of God the platform that then becomes the ground and basis for everything else, which I would argue sounds fairly logical. I mean, you sort of start with God, and then you don't define God on the basis of what God creates. If you define God, especially on the basis of a fallen creation, you can end up with some pretty goofy ideas of God. That's sort of what man's religion does. But open theism is very clear about what its central affirmation is. And that is, for man to be man and for true interaction to take place, there must be libertarian free will. And so that becomes the ground floor, and that becomes what cannot be possibly denied. Well, the problem with that then becomes, what will tomorrow bring for open theism? That is, this is not a system that has finished its development. In fact, the very term itself only came about a little over a decade ago in its current usage. And why was that? Because they were very, very, very concerned to differentiate themselves from another system, which I'm trying to remember if I have up here. We've already talked about these guys, haven't we? Especially Clark Pinnock is very, very concerned to separate open theism from what other movement? Process theology. Now, if you're not familiar with process theology, you are a blessed person. My systematic theology class was sort of unusual. My whole theological education has been unusual, but I took systematic theology from a professor who had just graduated from Fuller with his PhD in systematic theology. This is the first class he ever taught. One of his hobbies was to study process theology. Now, when someone has the hobby of studying process theology, that gives you some idea of what's going on here. And so he gave us just a tremendously detailed rundown of process theology. And as with everything in this class, the format of the presentation of any subject was, here's a movement, a belief, a doctrine. Here's the pros. Here's the cons. We move on from there. And I remember once during a break, we were we were walking over to a snack shop, and there was an attorney taking classes. And we were walking along, and he goes, "Well, that's all very interesting, but what do we believe about that?" What we believe was never really a subject of the systematic theology class, because, like I said, it was more a section of the history department than it was anything else. But he gave us a tremendously detailed overview of process theology, and I'll try to be very brief in defining it so you can see the difference between it and open theism, because they're very concerned about it. Process theology envisions the universe going in and out of existence in these discrete packets of time. They're very short packets of time, so we don't notice it. But the universe is actually going in and out of existence on this continuous basis. And God, in process theology, has no coercive power over the universe. He only has persuasive power. And so when the universe, in these little teeny tiny packets of time, we're talking nanoseconds, okay? So that's why we never see it, is it's just so fast, is that when the universe comes into existence, God is exerting his persuasive power to convince the universe, well, the way we used to put it at the time was to join the army, because the idea was to be the best you could be. And so wasn't that the old, be all that you can be? Yeah, join the army. So now it's an army of one, which I find to be one of the most ridiculous statements they've ever come up with, if you know anything about the military. But back then it was be all that you can be and all that stuff. So that's what God is doing, is he is trying to convince the universe to be the best that it can be. And then as the universe goes out of existence, God absorbs all the good and sloughs off the bad so that God grows with each one of these passing packets of existence. And you might say, well, try to convince the universe to be the best you can be. How can the only people you can really convince are humans, aren't they? No. On the process theology foundation, all the way down to molecules. Even you want libertarian free will. Rocks have will in this perspective. Molecules have will in this perspective. And in fact, disease, for example, is where a cell chooses not to be the best that it can be. God's trying to convince it to be the best that it can be, but disease is where a cell goes, no, I don't want to be the best I can be. And then you've got a problem. And so God is absorbing the good that comes out of his persuasive efforts. And you see, we get to sort of participate in this and sort of help God out by joining with him. Because certainly the future doesn't exist. God doesn't know what's going to happen there. And so we get to join and partner with God in seeking to make the world the best place that it can be. And in so doing, help God to get better, bigger, stronger, faster, more intelligent, and so on and so forth. And I'll never forget the professor, after he sort of gives us a rundown and he gave us lots of names and resources and books and things like that. He gets done with the prose, the positive presentation, and when he got to the negative, this is the only time in the entirety of the systematic theology class that I wanted to pump my fist or do something like that. He said, now, obviously on the negative side, the greatest negative that can be announced for process theology is the fact that the God of process theology bears no resemblance whatsoever to the God of the Bible. And I was like, yes, a black and white statement, a true false statement. Yes, this is very good. As you can tell, I didn't get a lot of those in some of my seminary classes. So I was sort of pumped when we finally got one. And of course, it's true. There is no similarity to the God of the Bible, of the God of process theology. But in open theism and process theology, the future is open. It's more open in process theology than it is in open theism. And Clark Pinnock especially is very sensitive to the charge of process theology. Because what's the thing that really, when I was going over that brief introduction to process theology, what's the thing that really bothers you about that? God is learning and growing and getting better? What an odd concept for us to contemplate. And so they want to avoid that. But the problem is, in open theism, God's learning as well. In fact, God is surprised. He's surprised at what we do. And so that would involve a gaining of knowledge, a gaining of experience as well. Is God better at dealing with humans now than he was 1,000 years ago? If you aren't better at your job 10 years into it, are you still going to have a job? Well, if God isn't better at dealing with human beings now than he was 1,000 years ago, so could God have done a better job? Then, you know, maybe that's why we had the flood. New job jitters. You don't know. Let's start this whole thing all over again, you know? I don't know. Quick summary statement. The future does not yet exist. Therefore, God does not know it. He is created in such a fashion the future is partly closed, that those things he will do, almost entirely in the natural realm, fires, earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, asteroids, I guess, would fall into that realm, and partly open, all those things related to the actions of free creatures, hence the term open theism, that there is an openness in the future and an openness in God's knowledge as well. They vehemently insist they are not promoting a simply more orthodox form of process theology, the concept that God is growing, changing, and learning with each passing moment, but at the same time, they have to admit that in their system, God is learning with the passage of time as he himself experiences the future. So, they insist that the picture of God found his interaction with mankind depends on, demands an open view of the future. God learns that Abraham will be faithfully obedient in Genesis 22. He uses terms like perhaps and if and makes conditional promises about Eli's sons that do not come true. Many feel there is truly no basis in the position for the doctrine of inerrancy, let alone the concept of biblical prophecy, nor any means of identifying a false prophet. In other words, upon what basis, upon what grounding in open theism can one come up with biblical prophecy? That is one of its biggest problematic areas. The same thing is true of inerrancy, because it would seem that each one of these individuals, Boyd's avoided it more than anybody else has, but both Pinnock and, thank you, Sanders, the guy I debated, the guy I drove down to Orlando with in the car, and we played basketball at somebody's house beforehand. He's got a killer 15-foot jumper. He's very wiry. They have more directly addressed this issue. And most of you know, at the Evangelical Theological Society meeting last year, they attempted to remove Clark Pinnock and John Sanders. Boyd's actually not a member, so you can't remove somebody who's not a member, on the issue of inerrancy, and failed. They were unable to do so. And so, in essence, I questioned the validity of that approach to begin with. I think the issue should be, well, if ETS does not want to make God's exhaustive knowledge of the future a part of its statement of faith, then live with the results. You know, this seemed to me like going in the back door. Though I would also say that I think there's good reason to question their doctrine of and their commitment to inerrancy. There's no two ways about it. Okay, let's talk about the major issues. Obviously, the big issue is sovereignty and immutability and all the things that flow from that. Does God have a purpose? Did God know that Eric here was going to exist when he created? The open theist says no. How then can God have a purpose for Eric's life? Well, I guess he makes it up as he goes along. The problem is, Eric, you don't cooperate with everything God wants to do. That's called sin. And so each time we mess up that process, evidently that plan for our life has to be rebuilt and redesigned. But what if I, all of a sudden, we do live in Arizona. I live in Arizona. We, not, that was a sort of majestic we, I guess. I live in Arizona, and we have We have something in Arizona called the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which most of the rest of you don't have any longer. And so I remember when I first moved into Arizona, I freaked out. We went to this place called Circle K. I don't think you have Circle K in Pennsylvania yet, but it's our version of 7-Eleven. We do have 7-Eleven, but Circle K is the big thing out there. And we were getting some milk or something one day, and all of a sudden I turn around, and there's a guy walking in, and he's packing heat. He's got probably a 44 Magnum strapped to his leg. And I came from back east. I'm ready to dive behind something, assuming immediately, of course, that bad things are about to happen. No, you can carry openly in Arizona. It's estimated 67% of all vehicles are armed, and that's why we are nice when we drive. You don't cut people off in Arizona because it could have deadly consequences. That's all there is to it. Now, I've driven on Long Island, so I know what happens when cars are unarmed. They drive like idiots. So anyway, I could all of a sudden, since I live in Arizona, freak God out by whipping out my Glock and taking Eric out. Now, let's say God was intending to use Eric tomorrow to make a tremendous discovery in the field of... What do you do, Eric? There you go. And Eric's going, why did I sit down front? Why do I have a name tag on? Eric's going to make a tremendous discovery. Pastor, Eric's going to make a tremendous discovery tomorrow in the field of theology. I just wanted you to know that. And that's what God wants to have happen. And Eric's going to be published, and he's going to travel all over the United States, and the church is going to be greatly blessed. But I all of a sudden mess everything up by pulling out my Glock and taking Eric out. So now what does God have to do? He has to start all over again. Every day, seemingly, would be an exhausting reworking of a plan that is constantly coming to frustration. Now, I used a wild example there, but what if I just simply took some cold medication that says right on the label, do not operate heavy machinery, but I'm a big guy. I've done it many times before. So I take some cold medication, and I'm out driving at night. I had LASIK surgery a few years ago, and my daytime vision's great, but at night, a little bit of that starry stuff going on, you know? And so you add to that the cold medication, and Eric's walking home someplace, and boom, no more Eric. One little choice on my part, unforeseen by God. All his great plans for blessing everybody through Eric's theological insight. And don't bother staying up all night trying to find that thing. I'm just using it as an illustration. All gone. It's history. How does God have a plan in that? The plan becomes very vague. Very vague indeed. It's God's going to win. How, when, with whom, don't know. God is developing. God is learning. I can't see how we can avoid the idea that he's growing. And one of the questions that people have is, if God has perfect knowledge of the present, how can he have that knowledge? You see, if he has perfect knowledge of the present, if he knows everything there is to know about me, is he really liable to be surprised by what I do? And so there's some who feel that somewhere down the line, open theists, to maintain the central plank of their position, which is libertarian free will, are going to have to begin to modify God's perfect knowledge of the present as well. And where does that lead? Who's to know? Who's to know? So this, of course, for me, is the central issue. I mean, if you have your scriptures with you, and I don't know which translation this is. It looks like the King James, so that'll work fine. Is that what it is? It'll work. Isaiah chapter 41. I was going to use Bible Works, but trying to do it backwards on the screen is a little bit difficult to do, so we'll just look at Isaiah chapter 41. Beginning of verse 21. Here in Isaiah you have the trial of the false gods. This was the primary passage I presented against Dr. Sanders, and I will leave it to you to determine how that debate went, but I don't believe that Dr. Sanders provided me with a meaningful response to these passages. I really do not believe that he did. And this is not the only one, but notice what's going on here. God is, in essence, calling the gods that Israel is embracing, the idols that Israel is worshiping, to sit in the witness chair and to give answer in the court of law. Verse 21, "Produce your cause, says the Lord. Bring forth your strong reasons, says the King of Jacob. Let them bring them forth and show us what will happen." Notice, show us what will happen. "Let them show the former things what they are, that we may consider them and know the result of them or the latter end of them, or declare us things that are to come. Show the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know that you are gods. Do good or do evil, that we may be dismayed and behold it together." That's sarcasm, in case you're wondering. Some people have problems with sarcasm in the Bible. There's a lot of it, especially of idols and people who would worship idols. Tremendous amount of sarcasm. And there, God is saying, do something that we may tremble in fear. You know, can you see this idol, one of those hideous things they've dug up in the Middle East, sitting, you know, if we had the witness chair here in a court of law, sitting there, and the attorney is saying, do something. And, of course, it can't. It's just an idol. And you can just see all of the worshipers of that idol sitting out there in the courtroom, sort of embarrassed by the fact their idol is just sitting there while it's being mocked. I seem to recall Elijah doing something along those lines as well. However, he followed that up with the death of hundreds of individuals. But anyway, but please notice specifically, verse 22, what's the challenge here? The challenge is, tell us what's going to happen. Come on, idol. Give us tomorrow's headlines. And be perfect about it. Don't do it just once. Let's see you do it for a little while. I mean, it's one thing to get a prediction right once in a while, but what's the biblical standard? Perfection. And God says the idols, I'll tell you what, I'll show you your idols by challenging you to do the things that only I can do. So God is using unique attributes that He possesses to demonstrate idols do not have these unique attributes. That's how you can tell the difference between me and an idol. And the challenge is, in verse 22, tell us what's going to happen, but then notice, it doesn't stop there. Sometimes people miss this. Then let them show us the former things, what they were. Now, wait a minute. Any decent historian can do that, right? I mean, we can narrate past events, sometimes very fully, sometimes not so fully. There's a big controversy in our land right now about events during the Vietnam War. And so books are being published, and you've got records from here, records from there, and this person was there, and this person says he was doing this on such and such a day, but actually here's the records to demonstrate he was over here. And so we can take these records and we can bring all this stuff together and we can talk about history. The closer the history is, normally the better we can get it. The farther away it is, the less information we have. But is God simply saying, give us a history lesson? No, because notice what he says. Show us the form of things that we may consider them and know, the King James says, the latter end of them. In other words, why it happened. Ooh. See, the historian can very frequently tell you what happened in the past. But the historian has to very frequently admit he hasn't a clue why it happened. Hasn't a clue. That's not even the historian's purview to answer that question. Oh, you can talk about causes and effects. But many times we just put our hands up and go, it was an amazing thing. Amazing thing. When I lived out here from age 6 to age 11, Every once in a while, my mom would take me out of school, just call in and say, Jimmy's not feeling well today. And we'd get in the car, and we'd drive the half mile to Gettysburg. And it wasn't until I was an adult that I truly appreciated the number of times I had been to Gettysburg as a youth. And especially if you are a Civil War aficionado, those of you who live out here. Living in Arizona stinks, being a Civil War aficionado. We have one battle out there, a minor little skirmish, and not really much to go look at. You can go see these things all the time. So you're just like we are. That is, you probably don't go because they're too easy to get to. Same with us out there. You know, the last time I was at the Grand Canyon was like 24 years ago. It's up there. It's always up there. I can just, you know, I can go up there anytime I want to. Actually, it was 22 years ago because it was on my honeymoon. It was about 20 years ago. I hiked it. So that was the last time I was there. So she'd take me down to Gettysburg. And I've read a lot on that subject. And you can always tell where somebody was born. I was born in Minneapolis, so it sort of tells my background. But I have a lot of friends from the South, and it's not the Civil War to them. Is the war of northern aggression, and some of them I'm truly expecting will scream out sometime during a service we're in. The South will rise again, and I will be very scared. But anyway, if you know anything about Gettysburg, you know that it was very close. On the second day of battle, the what would be from the Union side, the left side of the Union line, just barely held up there on Little Round Top. And if it had broken, who knows what would the result of that would have been. And most of you know that Lee, one of the reasons for that was that his eyes were gone, not his physical eyes, but his cavalry. His cavalry was off having a grand old time someplace else, not doing what they're supposed to do. He didn't know the land. Well, what if that general had just decided to be more conscientious about his orders and to make sure that General Lee always knew exactly what was around him? This whole nation could be different. This whole world could be different. One little decision, cascading upon itself over time, could completely change the outcome of everything. Why did things happen? Why did he do that? Well, some people think that particular general, who liked to dress in a very fancy way, was just enjoying getting his name in the newspapers. That's the way he was. And so when verse 22 says that we may know the latter end, we may know why, there has to be a purpose for there to be a way. And God's not going to challenge the idols to do what he himself cannot do. It is this high theology of God, this high biblical theology of God, that is at stake in this particular discussion. Is there a purpose in creation? When God created, did he have a purpose? Some would say, yes, he was lacking something. There are many who say that, if you find that surprising. There are many credentialed theologians who would say God was lacking something, he was missing something, and we fill in that gap. It concerns me, especially when they say, well, God wanted someone to love. That one makes me just shudder. Because if you consider the doctrine of the Trinity and the perfection of love that exists between the divine persons, it truly worries me when people say, well, God, you know, was missing something in that way. But when God purposed to create, in essence, from the open theistic perspective, and this is one of the objections I raised to Dr. Sanders, from the open theistic perspective, God knew the possibilities when he created. He knew this could go terribly wrong. He knew that it could result in a torrent of evil. But he did it anyway. But it wasn't his purpose that any of that should exist. For some reason, people are much more comfortable with that view. God didn't intend it. It's sort of like, you know, you see a person sitting in a car and What happened? Where was it that the very elderly man recently? What was it? Two months ago? Something happened. He got confused. It was sort of like my son the first time we went driving. He got confused too between the brake and the accelerator. A bad thing to get confused about. Very bad thing to get confused about. That was a $3,000 bad thing for my son to get confused about. But for this fellow, it was, I think, a 7 fatality, 29 injured bad thing to get confused about. Because he ended up going through a market, an open air market. And people look at that man sitting in a police car, looking all confused and dazed, and they're like, aw. Aw. And it seems to be how people want to look at God. Oh, God created all this, and wow, it really went haywire, but he didn't intend it that way. And they like that view better than the idea that God actually had a purpose. And yet, I remember Joseph. Joseph evidently had not read Clark Pinnock and John Sanders. And when Joseph's father dies, his brothers come before him knowing he's the second most powerful man in Egypt and could have them all executed by a wave of his finger. Knowing what they did to him, remembering the coat of many colors in a certain pit and certain slave traders. They come before him and they know they can't escape, so they might as well try to throw themselves on his mercy. And Joseph weeps. Evidently, though he had expressed his forgiveness and love for his brothers many times, they had not believed him. And what does Joseph say? Well, Joseph didn't go to seminary. But in a sense, he went to a much higher school of theology. He sat in a slave caravan in shock. He sat in a prison and was forgotten. And oh, the years that passed by. He learned something about God's sovereignty and God's providence, really in the only way that you can really learn it, not as simply a external thing that, well, I know this, but as something that really means something in here. He had learned all those things. And his brothers come before him, and he didn't dispassionately sit back and discourse upon the relationship of God's will to the world or anything else. He took his theology and he applied it directly. And he said he didn't whitewash sin. He wasn't a postmodernist. He said, you intended this for evil. I know that. You hated me. You, what you did was sinful. You not only sold me into slavery, but how on earth did you stand there when our father was weeping his eyes out for days and weeks on end in stony, cold-hearted silence as he grieved and died in front of you? At least his heart did. And you all knew it was all a lie. That was evil. And he didn't whitewash it. He said, what you did, you intended for evil. But then, and if you've looked at it in Hebrew, you know this is the case. In direct parallel, you can't break it apart. He doesn't use different terms. He says, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. To save many people alive to this day. Now, I'm sorry, I've asked a lot of folks, how do you get your theology out of that text? How do you look at that text and go, well, no, God just permitted this, or no, what you intended for evil, God intended. Just as they had an intention, and it was an evil intention, God had a holy, just, and good intention. And the purpose was to save many people alive today. How in the world can an open theist look at that? Think of all the free will choices involved in the life of Joseph that Joseph had no control over. His brothers, the slave traders, Potiphar, Potiphar's wife, the judges involved, the wine taster, the food taster, the Pharaoh. He had no control over any of that, and neither did God. So how in the world could God intend to keep many people alive when there was no way God could even see? Well, he could see the famine coming. Couldn't see that because he was going to bring it. But he couldn't see how anybody would react to Joseph or how Joseph himself would react. And yet there is the clear intention of God right there in the text. And how did Joseph discover that? Did he go to seminary to discover that? Nope. He lived it. He watched it. He experienced it. Can God have a purpose in creation? The biggest objection I raised to Dr. Sanders was just this. When God created, God knew it was possible that all this evil could exist. And he created anyways without a purpose. So that means all this evil exists, but there's not a purpose in it all. You can't say there's any purpose to what's going on in the world today. You can't say there's any purpose to the suffering of Christians under Muslim rule. We hear about young, beautiful Christian girls in Egypt or Saudi Arabia. And you know what happens to them, right? You know what Muslims like to do? Like to throw acid in their faces to disfigure them. God knew that was going to happen, but he had no purpose. See, I created. I knew it could happen, but I didn't know. I hoped better. I don't see the attraction in that person. But that's what people are saying. Biblical prophecy. I'll go to about 11:30, then we'll take some questions and take a break at that point. Biblical prophecy. Wow, it's amazing to listen to open theists try to come up with a way that God can predict future events. And we're not talking about just weather situations, droughts and things like that. I like to ask the question about Cyrus. Now, when I do so, I then reveal how backwards and fundamentalistic I am, because I actually believe that Isaiah prophesied about Cyrus, and the easiest way around the Cyrus prophecy in Isaiah 45 is, it's Deutero-Isaiah, it was written after Cyrus, no big deal. But for those who actually seem to take Isaiah the same way that, well, the Lord did, I guess the Lord didn't know about Deutero-Isaiah or something like that, but I have to admit, just in passing, it was very strange to me that we would trust our eternal salvation to Christ, but we would not adopt his view of Scripture. I've never figured that part out. Anyway, that's neither here nor there, but it will be later. Isaiah prophesies that Cyrus is going to return the people. He names the man by name. And the open theist has a problem, because the open theist can say, well, you see, God has perfect knowledge of the present. But how does that explain how you could know the name of a child who's not yet born? Isn't naming pretty much a free will choice thing? I mean, you look at some of the names people come up with these days, and it has to be a free will choice thing. It might be an evidence for open theism. What was Zappa Moonbeam something? I don't know. I can't keep up with such things. How could God ground biblical prophecy in an open theistic perspective? It makes no sense. There could be no way that a prophecy could ever have specific information that would touch on anything that would involve the actions of free creatures. And yet, how many prophecies in the Bible do touch upon the action of free creatures? Not just Cyrus, but, and this one has come up many times, the Lord Jesus' own words to Peter on the night of his betrayal. Think of all the free will choices that went into Peter's denial. Peter had to choose to follow afar off. He could have run. He could have headed out of town. He could have headed back to Galilee. He could have been like John and gone inside, but he didn't. He could have chosen to not warm himself at the fire at all. He could have chosen at any point to leave. He could have chosen at any point to confess Christ. He could have chosen to deny Christ before the cock crowed the third time. There are all sorts of things that he could have chosen to do, all of which allegedly are outside the field of God's knowledge, let alone God's control. Are we really satisfied with the answer? Well, God knew Peter so well that he knew that Peter would choose to go and warm himself by the fire outside and that it would take three times before he would deny Christ. Is that really? And has anyone really given serious consideration to the idea of what would have happened had Jesus been wrong? The problem here is that what open theists end up doing, John Sanders does this, is in essence say sometimes God is wrong. Sometimes there are false prophecies. We just have defined false prophecy too narrowly. Okay. I seem to recall in Deuteronomy 13 and 18, there are fairly clear rules laid out concerning the detection of a false prophet. That seemed to be an important thing for the people of Israel. But to defend the concept of open theism, the very basis of biblical prophecy is allowed to be taken away. And it's one thing for us, you know, let's face it, sometimes we look around and you can sort of joke a little bit about some of the popular prophecy movements, you know, people traveling around doing their prophecy gig and then some people writing books and making gazillions of dollars off their prophecy gigs. And it's sort of like, yeah. But we're talking also about the very validity of not only looking back at specific prophecies, but isn't this also where God tells us how the end is going to end up? Isn't that sort of important too? That there's going to be an end, that good's going to triumph? That seems to be a part of the whole thing. And how do we know that some of those process theologians aren't right when they say, hey, if we don't cooperate, God doesn't win. We've got to get in there and fight. That's a good way to rally folks to the local building fund or something like that, but I'm not sure what kind of theology it ends up producing. This is not one you hear a lot about. Substitutionary atonement. There's something truly beautiful in considering the atonement of Christ and its intensely personal nature and our union with Christ. But I submit to you that in an open theistic system, the substitutionary atonement of Christ can no longer be affirmed. What I mean by that, and of course, I'm sure that most of you are already aware of this, but historically, Arminians did not believe in the substitutionary atonement of Christ. Historic Arminian theology believed in a federal government view of the atonement, not a substitutionary atonement, because they recognized if there was an actual substitution of Christ in behalf of any individual, that individual would be saved. That if the full punishment, the full wrath of God is poured out upon the substitute in the place of individual X, then there's no ground for the condemnation of individual X. And so historic Arminians didn't believe in substitutionary atonement. And so they don't, open theists, John Sanders, Clark Pinnock, Gregory Boyd, they all openly use the term Arminian of themselves. They just say that their fellow Arminians are inconsistent in holding on to this tradition of exhaustive divine foreknowledge of future events, and that they are the consistent Arminians in rejecting that. That's their argument. I'll let them fight that one out. But the idea of a substitutionary atonement, the best you can do within an open theistic system would be a very general, vague concept of the union of a people, but not the identity of those people, being united with Christ in His death. Sort of a, here's a general provision for X, but X will be filled by whoever chooses to fill X. Individuals don't die with Christ. A group, in general, dies with Christ, and you can join yourself with the group if you want. But the personal aspect can't exist. Why? Because open theists are very clear in admitting that God did not know you were going to exist when He created, and God did not know you were going to exist at the cross. God had no concept and could have no concept that James White would exist when Jesus Christ died upon the cross of Calvary. So I could not have been united with Him in His death, because God had no certain knowledge I would ever exist. He knew I was a possibility, but He had no certain knowledge that I would exist. And so the concept of substitutionary atonement becomes very problematic from an open theistic perspective. It has to be reduced to some sort of non-substitutionary methodology because of the fact that God cannot know that any human being is going to exist in the future. That is just one of many things that, again, brings us back to the real fundamental issue here. And that is, this whole concept is based upon the idea that, well, to be quite honest with you, we struggle.